From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a priest and a former priest discuss their views on celibacy and the priesthood. At the age of 28, James Martin left the corporate world to take his vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. He is a Jesuit priest who is associate editor of the Catholic magazine America. He recently wrote a piece about the value of celibacy. Eugene Kennedy left the priesthood after 22 years to marry and has now been married 25 years. He wishes he could have remained a priest after marriage. Kennedy is the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording by Polish violinist Ida Haendel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorney General John Ashcroft has announced new guidelines for the FBI. Ashcroft says the agency's expanded abilities are aimed at helping the FBI prevent terrorist attacks. The change will give the Bureau new powers to gather information. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The new guidelines allow FBI agents to use the Internet and computer databases to collect information. They also allow agents to attend public events at places like libraries and churches. The FBI has been barred from those kind of information gathering activities. Attorney General Ashcroft says those restrictions may have made sense for the FBI when they were drawn up 20 years ago, but no longer.
It cannot meet its paramount responsibility to prevent acts of terrorism if the FBI agents are required, as they have been in the past, to blind themselves to information that is available for everyone else.
Ashcroft says the guidelines also extend new authority to FBI field offices to begin their own investigations into terrorist activities without approval from Washington. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
A rescue helicopter crashed near the top of Oregon's Mount Hood today as the crew tried to rescue a group of climbers who'd fallen into a crevasse. Television news helicopters showed the crash as the National Guard helicopter dipped its nose toward the mountainside. The helicopter's propellers shattered and the aircraft rolled down the snowy slope. A spokeswoman for the sheriff's office said at least one person on the helicopter was critically injured. The helicopter was trying to rescue survivors after 9 climbers plunged into a crevasse. 3 of the climbers were killed by the fall, and 3 others were critically injured. The accidents happened just a day after at least 2 climbers died in a snowstorm on Washington's Mount Rainier. Police in Utah now say they foiled a plot in February in which white supremacists allegedly targeted Jewish athletes at the Winter Olympics. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
Police in Ogden, Utah say an informant told them in January that members of a white supremacist group were making pipe bombs and would use them against Jewish athletes during the Olympics. Investigators considered the information credible and placed suspects under surveillance. 2 people believed involved in the alleged plot were arrested on unrelated charges just before and immediately after the games began. An FBI spokesman says an extensive investigation failed to turn up hard evidence of the plot or any sign of the pipe bombs. Agents even searched a place where bombs were supposedly stored, but none were found. Still, Ogden police say the suspects were known to be violent white supremacists capable of building explosives. They believe the informant's tip and ensuing surveillance and arrest prevented an attack. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 11 points to close at 9,911 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 7 points. This is NPR News. Officials in Arizona have reopened their side of Hoover Dam and Interstate Highway 93 after a suspicious object was checked by a bomb squad and found to be harmless. The highway was closed for about 2.5 hours while experts examined the object, which was found in a parking lot on the Arizona side of the dam, which spans the Colorado River between Arizona and Nevada. The object was found to be an ammunition box that had been converted into a chalk container for marking construction sites. The visitor center on the Nevada side of the dam remained open during the search. The Bishop of Peoria, Illinois, has removed 7 priests from public ministry. Charlie Schlenker reports from member station WGLT.
Newly installed Bishop Daniel Janke has made good on promises of reform by removing the priests because of allegations of sexual misconduct with minors dating as far back as the 1960s. Kate Kenney, a spokeswoman for the Peoria Diocese, says Bishop Janke is trying to offer comfort to 29 known victims as well as be proactive for the rest of the 250,000 Catholics in central Illinois.
He is hoping to reassure the flock that he's handling this situation as best that he can.
Only two of the former priests had public allegations against them before the announcement. Bishop Janke has also created a review commission to investigate future allegations. The panel includes four women, attorneys, a clinical psychologist, a former police officer, and a Protestant clergy member. For NPR News, I'm Charlie Schlenker in Normal, Illinois.
The crew of the space shuttle Endeavour is aboard and waiting for a planned launch in just about 40 minutes. Space agency officials are warning that stormy weather could prevent the launch. The shuttle is preparing to carry a replacement crew to the International Space Station. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sexual abuse scandals in the Catholic Church have raised many questions about the priesthood. For example, could we prevent this type of problem if priests were allowed to marry? My guest, Father James Martin, recently wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times titled Choosing Celibacy, in which he discussed the reasons for this tradition and its value in the life of a priest. Father Martin is a Jesuit priest and associate editor of America, a national Catholic magazine. He joined the Jesuits after 6 years in the corporate world. 2 years ago, he published a memoir titled In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. You say that many Americans don't understand celibacy, that they see it at best as misguided and at worst as masochistic, and they say, what kind of sick person would willingly give up sex? What is the reason for celibacy in the priesthood as you understand it?
Well, as I understand it, celibacy is meant to free a person up for unselfish service to God and to other people. And I always tell people the reason for celibacy is really to help people love other people, love many other people very deeply. It's not for everybody. It's not meant to be for everybody. It's not better or worse than married life or single life. But for some people, it's a wonderful way of serving God.
You became a priest after about 6 years in the corporate world, working for GE.
That's right.
You were already an experienced man of the world when you became a priest. How did you feel then about the prospect of forsaking a sexual life? You were in a different position than the teenager who decides to become a priest, who hasn't experienced the world as an adult yet.
Well, that's a good question. You know, honestly, I didn't really consider it too much, and that's a little embarrassing to say, but I went into the priesthood without much sexual experience and, you know, kind of thought it would be an easy thing to give up for me. As it turns out, it wasn't. Celibacy is very difficult. I think chastity is probably the most difficult of the three vows for a Jesuit to live. That's poverty, chastity, and obedience. But to be honest with you, even at age 28, I don't think I really reflected on the challenges of celibacy and what that would really mean for me. I saw it as something that would probably be easy to give up. And looking back on it, I think that was pretty foolish.
So what was the most difficult part of it? What did you feel like, in retrospect, you were naive about?
I guess the propensity to fall in love, even when you are living a vow of chastity. I think that somehow I thought, I can't believe sort of looking back how naive I was, but that somehow by just sort of taking the vow, that would preclude my falling in love and that would preclude my desiring intimacy. But I think one of the things you learn about chastity is that one grows into it. And also one learns, the real need that everybody has for really deep intimacy.
Excuse this question, which is probably naive. I should probably already know the answer to this, but the truth is that I don't. Do you have to be a virgin when you become a priest, or can you just like begin a life of celibacy after entering the priesthood?
The latter. You don't have to be a virgin when you enter. Mm-hmm. In fact, most people these days who are entering in their mid-20s and early 30s are probably not. I mean, I couldn't say, but I think most of my friends who entered were not. So, yeah, virginity is really different than celibacy. And I think vocations would be really down if they only accepted virgins.
But a lot of people probably enter the priesthood as virgins. The younger people who enter, who have never experienced sexuality at all. Do you think that a life of celibacy becomes more difficult for them because they don't even know what it is they've given up, and the temptation of that might be so great because it's something that you've never had?
I think that's a good question. I'm not sure your question about younger people entering as virgins. I think, you know, just sort of anecdotally from people that I speak with, I don't think that's the case. And also remember, a lot of the people who are entering these days are entering at a much older age, particularly in diocesan seminaries. But the other question about not having had experience, I think it would make it more difficult. I think, you know, if you did enter without having sexual experience, or I think more to the point, without being in a very intimate relationship with another person, I think you always would wonder, you know, what it is like and what I'm giving up. But frankly, it's the same thing with people, I think, who enter right out of college. I know a lot of people who entered very early on who wonder, you know, what it would be like to hold a job, what it would be like to have their own apartment, things like that. So I think in general, people realize these days, the more experience people have in all different parts of life, the better it is for them when they, you know, eventually become a priest.
In the Jewish religion, rabbis are usually expected to have a family. Mm-hmm. Ministers, too, I think, are usually, you know, expected to have a family. Can you imagine being a priest and being married?
Yeah, I can. Quite frankly, I'm for optional celibacy. I think, you know, it's not for everybody, and I really don't think that it needs to be a requirement in the church. I think, frankly, the strongest reason for that is the fact that I know many people who are married who feel called to priesthood. But really, from the beginning, it was never an issue of doctrine. It was more an issue of sort of church law. And even as far back as the 16th century, they said that the church said that it would be something that would be easy to change, unlike, say, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity or something like that.
We're talking about celibacy for priests in the church. My guest is Father James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest and associate editor of America, a national Catholic magazine. He's also the author of several books, including In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. There are several theories about how chastity might figure into the current sex abuse scandal. Mm-hmm. One theory is that young men who become priests, who have no sexual experience, also often don't have much sexual understanding. They haven't gotten that understanding through experience. The church doesn't usually teach human sexuality in an effective way. And these men, these young priests, don't know how to deal with their own sexual urges. And so those urges can get expressed in harmful ways.
Well, I think that may have been the case 40 or 50 years ago. But honestly, I mean, in the last, say, 10 or 20 years, there's been an enormous amount of attention given to the education of seminarians and people in religious formation, that would be members of religious orders like the Jesuits and Franciscans and Dominicans, to ensure that they have a healthy understanding of their own sexuality. And, you know, in point of fact, I often, you know, tell my friends who are married that I think priests and Jesuits and whatnot talk about sexuality much more because we're constantly being sort of counseled, and we go to courses, and we, you know, read about it, and we study about it. So I think that might have been the case 40 or 50 years ago, but certainly these days it would be very difficult for someone to go through a mainstream seminary or one of the larger religious orders without having to sort of come face-to-face with your own sexuality and the challenges that are really inherent in celibacy.
What do you study when you study human sexuality?
Well, we study human sexuality sort of from a psychological standpoint. We also study sort of the history of celibacy. I think more to the point, it's a lot of counseling that goes on with your superiors. It's a lot of discussions that go on with your spiritual directors, that is the person you would talk to about your spiritual life. You know, a lot of us will go to psychiatrists and psychologists to make sure we understand everything about our sexuality. So it's pretty extensive. I mean, from the first year of my novitiate as a Jesuit, we talked about chastity and celibacy and sexuality a lot. And the other thing is, it's not something that happens in a vacuum. I mean, I speak with, I think this is the case for most young priests. You know, I still have obviously friends that I had before I entered the Jesuits, and so I talk to them about their experiences. I talk to married friends, I talk to single friends. So I think it's pretty in-depth. At least it was for me. I can't speak for everybody, but I feel that certainly, you know, the amount of time that I spent on thinking and praying about sexuality and chastity was a lot, frankly. I think it was more than we talked about poverty, let's put it that way.
So you don't think that chastity is one of the major factors in the current sex abuse scandal in the church. What are your thoughts about why there has been so much sexual abuse?
Well, you know, I always say it's not a question of chastity or not chastity. It's a question of healthy and unhealthy. It's a difficult question. I think I would point to a couple of factors. First of all is the unwillingness of some of the people in the hierarchy to really confront some of these priests who have these problems. I would say that secondly, there's just an awkwardness and a discomfort when it comes to speaking about sexuality among members of the hierarchy who are, you know, in their 60s and 70s, and I think just weren't brought up to talk about those kinds of things. Third of all, I think that this notion of the hierarchy as always being right and people being unwilling to kind of challenge that. And fourth, just, you know, a desire, misguided as we see, to protect the institutional church. And when you combine all of those things, and you combine that with some people who may have had a very unhealthy sexuality that should have been weeded out of the seminaries and the priesthood earlier, you know, you have this horrible problem. And then there's also the tendency to, I think, be overly forgiving towards some priests at the expense of some of the victims. And once again, all those things thrown together make it, as we can see, or as we've seen, a very dangerous place.
How do you think the sex abuse scandal is affecting Catholics in America?
I think they're very demoralized, very sad, confused. It's really devastating. I think unlike some people compare it to the crisis that surrounded the publication of the encyclical on birth control, Humanae Vitae, in 1968, and the sort of reaction to that. But I think the difference is this hits people, you know, very personally. It's your pastor who you know. It's a family who you know down the street. So it's a very personal and very sensitive part of a person's psyche that this is affecting. And I think that's making it all the more difficult for people. And I also think that, you know, as I do, they look at the actions of some of the bishops, not all of the bishops, but some of the bishops, and just scratch their heads and say, I simply do not understand why a priest who had been sort of a serial abuser was moved from parish to parish. And quite frankly, I don't either. And I'm, you know, I'm sad myself. I find it very disturbing. By the same token, I think you have to understand that Catholics do not sort of place their faith, so to speak, in the hierarchy. I mean, they trust in the hierarchy. That's a very important part of Catholicism. But their faith is in Jesus Christ, and their faith is in the Holy Spirit guiding the church. So I think most Catholics are sophisticated enough to be able to distinguish between the hierarchy and their faith. Thank God.
My guest is Father James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest and the associate editor of the Catholic magazine America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Father James Martin, and he is a Jesuit priest. He's also associate editor of America, which is a national Catholic magazine. He's the author of several books. His latest is called In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. Father Martin, you became a priest after about 6 years in the corporate world. Why did you leave the corporate life to become a priest? That's really... From GE to the priesthood is a big lifestyle change.
Yeah, it was. There's a short answer to that question, and the answer is I was miserable. I was working for GE for 6 years, and I remember thinking at the time that the logic of my life was rather circular. I worked so I could make money so I could buy clothes and food and support myself and so I could work, which didn't seem to make too much sense. And I was working more and more. I was working human resources with GE Capital, which is their financial services arm, and getting more and more disenchanted with the way that my life was going and was getting very stressed out. One night I came home and turned on the TV late at night, and there was a TV show on PBS about Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, and I found it fascinating. He, too, had, although in the 1930s, had given up, you know, life in, quote-unquote, the world to enter a Trappist monastery, and that just appealed to me, and I started reading more about religious life, and one thing led to another, and I entered the Jesuits. Quite frankly, with very little reflection as I look back on it. But it worked out.
Did you find many men your age?
Oh, yeah. Most of the people that I entered with were... I entered when I was 28 years old, and most of the people in the novitiate were peers or older. One guy I entered with was a college professor. One guy had been in the Air Force. Another fellow had been in the priesthood, actually, the diocesan priesthood before any of the Jesuits. So, you know, a lot of different types of experience, which I think makes for healthier priests, quite frankly, and priests that can understand the challenges that, you know, people face day to day.
I've seen so many old movies in which the mother cries out of happiness because her son is becoming a priest, and she so much wants one of her sons to be a priest, and she's so proud. You say that when you decided to become a priest, your mother cried, but that's because she was so upset. She really didn't want you to do it. Why not?
No, she didn't. I think that's the case for some guys today. She saw me as, you know, giving up a family. I think the fact that she wouldn't have grandchildren, oh, thank God my sister's had a child a couple years ago, so that made her happy. Yeah, and also, people don't know priests these days. There are fewer and fewer of us around, and so there's a lot of mystery about what the life of a priest is really like. I remember my mother years later told me that she thought she would never see me again, that, you know, I'd be sort of locked up. And quite frankly, my friends were just as shocked and horrified. A lot of them thought I was crazy. And
well, you say a lot of them thought that you were running away from responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I always tell people I was running away from some things. I was running away from the corporate world that I thought was, for me, very deadening. And I was running towards something that I, you know, I really hope would give my life more meaning. Interestingly, most of my friends who were reluctant to sort of accept the fact that I was entering the priesthood only really understood it when they met other Jesuits. That was the thing that helped them understand what I was doing. And now they're all, you know, really all of my friends from college and from work are used to it. And, you know, I do a lot of weddings and baptisms and things like that, which is great. And they keep me sane and they keep me honest, too. You know, it's very hard to be sort of overly pious and overly spiritual among, you know, people who saw you get drunk during college.
Right. Something you say in your book, In Good Company, really struck me because I have a feeling it's true of a lot of people, although we don't necessarily think of it in these terms. You say that your religious education stopped when you were about 10, and that's about mm-hmm. when you stopped going to church, so that your idea of religion kind of froze from a children's perspective, and mm-hmm. that you grew up equipped with only a child's view of religion and faith. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you know, I think these days most Catholics, or many Catholics, shall we say, they go to CCD, which is sort of Sunday school, and they might continue that until confirmation. And, you know, if you don't go to a Catholic high school or a Catholic college, your religious education pretty much stops, and you are equipped with, as I said in this In Good Company book, this basically, you know, fourth grade understanding of what is a sin, what is a sacrament, what does it mean to live a good life, you know, which is fine when you're in fourth grade, but when you're, you know, in your 20s and 30s, it doesn't work very well. I often tell people, you know, it's like ceasing your education in mathematics at for fourth grade and, you know, being expected to kind of, you know, be in the real world and, you know, understand things. It just doesn't work. But I think that's the situation for a lot of Catholics, and I think that's why, you know, Catholics have such a hard time sometimes grappling with issues of papal infallibility, of doctrine, of dogma, of, you know, what it means to be a Catholic, because frequently their education as Catholics stopped at, you know, childhood. I find this a lot of times in the confessional without revealing any secrets. People will confess something, they'll say, well, is that a sin, yes or no? You know, it's this kind of black and white understanding that they may have learned from, you know, Sunday school in fourth grade, which, you know, doesn't, I think, equip you very well to live as an adult Catholic.
And is there a thing that you think you can do to contribute to a more adult understanding, a more in-depth, complicated understanding of Catholicism?
Yeah, I've always thought that what the church really needs to do is, I mean, this sounds really banal, but, you know, a more adult education and inviting people to learn more about their faith and to sort of reflect on their faith and reflect on moral questions. But it's a very difficult thing to do, I think, because once someone has that idea of Catholicism in their mind as this sort of black and white yes or no faith that's cemented in them as a child, when you talk to them about nuance, when you talk to them about church teaching and, for example, church history, sometimes they get upset and they feel that you're trying to, well, excuse things, or you're trying to, you know, deny what they've learned. So, for example, if let's say we're going to talk about celibacy in a married priesthood, if someone was taught in the fourth grade that, you know, this is the way it's always been, when you talk to them about church history and say, for example, you know, look at the early church, look at St. Peter, they feel like you're trying to, you know, sort of undermine what they've learned and what they see as their faith, which they find sometimes very threatening. So it's very difficult. I think it's a question of kind of inviting people to more adult reflection through education, books, things like that.
You said that when you became a priest, you entered the priesthood really naively. At what point did you really have confidence that you'd made the right decision?
Oh, that took a while. As a Jesuit, you have about 11 years of training before ordination. And I think it's sort of a gradual process. The time that I really knew that I was meant to be a Jesuit, I think, was when I was working in Africa with refugees. I spent 2 years helping refugees start small businesses. And I experienced this wonderful sense of just being in the right place and in the right time and doing exactly what I should be, which was the opposite of my experience at work, where I felt that I was in the wrong place. So I remember it came very powerfully one day that you're in the right place, and yes, this is where you should be. And that was, for me, you know, a wonderful confirmation of my choice.
Well, Father Martin, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Father James Martin wrote a memoir titled In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. This August, his new book will be published, titled Searching for God at Ground Zero. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cats and Men, stories by Nina de Gramont, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, leaving the priesthood for married life, we talk with Eugene Kennedy about why he made the decision. He's the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. And Lord Schwartz reviews the new recording by violinist Ida Haendel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eugene Kennedy, left the priesthood to marry. He believes that celibacy should be optional and that priests should be allowed to marry. He's thought a lot about sexuality and the church, including the current sexual abuse scandal. Kennedy is the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He's a psychologist who has counseled many priests, and he headed the psychological panel of a multidisciplinary study of the American priesthood that was commissioned by the country's Catholic bishops. Kennedy is professor emeritus of psychology at Loyola University. You were a priest for 22 years. You've been married for 25.
Right. And think I'm doing better at one than the other?
You left the priesthood in order to marry. How did getting married win out over staying in the priesthood? How did you make that decision?
Well, you know, when we speak about love in the English language, we say you fall in love. And that's a very interesting way of putting it, because you can't inch your way into love. You can't talk your way into it. You have to fall. You have to let go. And if you are in love with someone, as I was fortunate enough to fall in love, that as an experience caused me to come in conflict with the priesthood, which required me not to be married. I was very happy as a priest. And actually, in many ways, my life didn't change very much. I was still a professor, still a writer and a lecturer. And while I regret that that choice had to be made, I am not at all unhappy that I made it.
When you first became a priest, how did you feel about facing a celibate life?
Well, I became a priest in an age when there were tremendous social supports for the priesthood that no longer exist. The general American culture was intact. The Catholic culture within that general American culture was very close-knit and gave great support to those who entered the seminary and came back to serve their people in the priesthood in one way or the other. The change in the general culture and in the Catholic culture, of course, have had a big effect on the culture of the priesthood since that time. I feel that I was enjoyed being a priest. I would continue to enjoy being a priest. But the prospect of marriage was not one that, within that culture and within the general American culture, seemed nearly as attractive at the time I was in the seminary as was pursuing the ideal of the priesthood.
What's your understanding of the history of celibacy in the Catholic Church?
Well, celibacy has been an ideal of various kinds in throughout all of history, and has certainly been identified in the early days of the Church, especially in certain monastic settings and so forth, or certain very special forms of life. But the first pope, of course, was married, and that is not at all outside the tradition of the popes. There are many popes who have been married, and the whole Eastern Orthodox Church is part of the Catholic Church, but its priests have been married. So it is a long history that in the Roman Church was changed by the Pope known as Hildebrand, who introduced this as a discipline required of all priests, not so much for ascetic reasons, although it is not without its ascetic properties, even in secular appraisals of it, but in order to control the passage by inheritance of lands and prevent that from happening in the way that priests might hand on what they had gained during their lifetime to their children, and so have it pass out of the control of the church itself. That is why it's called a discipline. It is to control a problem that was economic and sociological rather than to bring some sort of spiritual additive to the priesthood.
When you became a priest, what was your understanding of the reason that celibacy is demanded of priests?
It was proposed in the seminary, not as it was found in history, but as that which made you available to more people than you would be available to if you were married and had a family to whom you had to return every evening and whose concerns would naturally preoccupy you during the day. That is the kind of ideal that Cesar Chavez, the famous farm worker leader whom I knew, spoke to me about once. He said that the farm workers liked to have their priests celibate because, he said, then we really had a feeling that they belonged to us and to our communities. So there are many aspects of it that are very honored in the way that good priests live this life. And that was very much the emphasis that it was given, that it wasn't that you were giving up human relationships, is that you were giving them up in a certain specific way in order to be able to relate to the whole family of the community that you would be serving in an intimate way.
Did you ever see celibacy as an ascetic approach in the way that, say, fasting is? And many people who've fasted over a long period of time say that it can help you achieve an almost altered state, an almost mystical state. Is celibacy connected to that in any way, in your understanding?
Celibacy only means that you're unmarried. There is a good deal of collateral literature that tries to romanticize it into a theologically extraordinary state, but I believe very few people experience it in that fashion. Many years later, when I was the chairman of the psychological panel for the National Conference of Bishops in a multidisciplinary study we did of the priesthood, we examined how priests, in fact, did live their celibate lives. What we discovered was that most American priests, this was after Vatican II had concluded when we did these interviews and drew up this report for the bishops, American priests, we found, observed their celibacy quite well. Those who were healthy men, it takes a very healthy person to lead a celibate life, however. I will return to that in a moment. But even in the healthiest of priests, those who are living very full lives, those who are very active and would fulfill surely the ideal that Cesar Chavez had of the priests belonging to the whole community, they adapted themselves to celibacy. They adjusted to it rather than making it the focus of some sort of effulgent state of grace. They adjusted to it the way that an early widower would have to adjust to not being married, or the way that a confirmed bachelor might after many years. We found that they accepted it, bore such inconveniences and difficulties as it brought with it. It brought also certain conveniences with it, for that matter.
Like what?
Well, I believe it drew a certain amount of respect to them. They were thought to stand in a neutral corner when they were working with people. Their sacrifice was somewhat over-idealized, but this did bring them a measure of respect within the community, which brought them not only tip-tats and gratitude, but many signs of social support and welcome in the homes of people that were very real and very true and therefore very supportive for them.
You would like to see both celibate and married priests?
I believe that celibacy has a real role in general life, as I said before, and certainly in the priesthood. There are wonderful celibate priests serving generously who have honored all their commitments all their lives. They are living under the shadow of this terrible crisis. It's very demoralizing and a terrible thing for them. I think we should ratify their choice of celibacy, but I think that in the future it should be something that they are free to make themselves if they wish, but it should not be a discipline that is demanded of people who may not understand enough about themselves to make that choice at that time. Freely chosen, I believe it can be a wonderful expression of generous hearts. Enforced on people as a condition, it can be something that incubates the kinds of problems that we have seen become so floridly infectious before us in recent months.
My guest is Eugene Kennedy. He's a former priest and the author of the book The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eugene Kennedy. He was a priest for 22 years. He left in order to marry. He's been married for 25 years. He's also the author of the book The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. You not only headed up this multidisciplinary study of the American priesthood, you've worked as a clinical psychologist, as a layperson, and your clients have included many priests, some of whom were struggling with sexual issues.
Yes.
A lot of people are wondering whether celibacy is related in any way to the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church now. With all this, with the study that you did and with your work as a psychologist counseling priests, do you see any connection between celibacy and the sexual abuse problem?
Well, I do not believe that celibacy in itself causes sexual abuse any more than marriage in itself causes divorce. But marriage is certainly involved in divorce, and celibacy can be involved in a certain way, at least a pseudo-celibacy, as a veil, in a way, behind which an underdeveloped person may, without any sort of stress, any real thought of ever being married, may move into the priesthood and bring with him the baggage that he has never opened before he enters the real world and works with other people. That is the real problem that I believe celibacy may be associated with, this problem, not so much as a causative agent, but as this veil behind which these people pass for having resolved the challenges that go with it.
What do you mean by underdeveloped person? And what's an example of a type of problem a so-called underdeveloped person might have that would lead them to choose the celibate life, perhaps for the wrong reason?
By an underdeveloped person, I mean we found in the studies that we did, there were certain groups of men who entered the priesthood who had not completed what was needed for the various growth stages that we all have to pass through to become adults. They might have looked adult from the outside, but internally, their internal growth did not match their chronological age. Typically, they had not worked out the challenges of adolescence and were functioning at a prepubescent level. That meant that they might have made friends with the same sex, but they had not passed through that chum stage in order to reach that level where they could make relationships with the opposite sex. These people are very ill-prepared, therefore, to deal with the challenges of celibacy because they are so far back in the growth cycle on understanding themselves and the way they relate to other people that the idea of relating to a woman is so far beyond them as to be excluded altogether. These are the kind of people who are particularly vulnerable, therefore, to having breakdowns marked by sexual misbehavior once they were out in the priesthood and no longer had the supports of the seminary to prop them up.
You've said that in your work as a clinical psychologist that with many of the priests who you were seeing, you heard more sadness than sin in their troubling stories. What do you mean?
Well, I think that in most of these stories, even in some of the terrible stories we hear today, one of the elements that we have put aside somewhat is trying to understand how these things could have happened in the first place. How, as you put it earlier, these people who had taken a vow of chastity could have acted out as sexual predators and done such harm to other individuals. Right now we're in a kind of, as they have a punitive stage in a trial, we're in a punitive stage in dealing with this problem. People are trying to find out some way to punish these people adequately. But the question remains, how did this happen in the first place? That question has not been asked by the bishops, but it is the question. The bishops are meeting in Dallas in June, and they are meeting largely to prescribe punishments for a problem that they have not defined and that they give no evidence of understanding. This is a recipe for a tragedy. What we do not understand is what can harm you. What we do not understand about the sexual problems in the priesthood is what has harmed us and harmed, unfortunately, many innocent people, perhaps beyond any numbering of them. I believe that these churchmen should, in fact, ask this question: how could this have ever come to be in people supposedly trained for selfless lives? What is it about the way we recruit them, the way we train them, the way we assign them, whatever questions that might bring them closer to the truth would be the most important questions they have asked. They have avoided asking this question, but it is still the pressing question. If they do not get some information about the causes, they should not spend any time trying to deal with cleaning up the effects.
As a psychologist, what kind of questions, what kind of approach do you think the church could take to screening out candidates for the priesthood who aren't sexually mature, who can't really handle the celibate life, or who aren't even prepared for a sexual life?
Well, I think we should junk the whole system that we have.
Uh-huh.
I believe this problem is systemic, that it is so inbred in the system of recruiting young people in adolescence or even now later in life and trying to force them into an old-fashioned seminary system that cannot be tinkered with any further. That should be put aside, and we should return to another way of recruiting people to serve in the priesthood. We should also have a broader vision of those who may serve in the priesthood. There certainly should be some consideration given to allowing women to be priests, for example. When I say junk the whole system, I don't mean that we should cavalierly put aside sensible things, but there is a certain time in which you are convinced that this isn't working and we have to do something new. The something new that I would advocate is actually something old, and that is to allow the Christian communities to choose themselves those who will celebrate the Eucharist and the other sacraments for them. St. Augustine, one of the great figures of all Christian and world history, became a priest because his community drafted him, in effect, for the job. The community of ordinary people is very wise. They can tell who's genuine and who is not, who is grown and who is not, and who has the demeanor that they would look for in someone who would be their priest. You have to put aside all these other artificial distinctions that he must be male, that he must be unmarried, and so forth.
I assume that you have served as a psychologist for priests who were having sexual problems, who either were or were potential abusers. What kind of work could you do with them to either prevent that from happening or to prevent it from happening any further?
Well, I don't think that these people can be remade. Not many of us can be remade, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that there are certain treatments that can help them observe their own behavior, cognitive and behavioral therapies, for example, that allow them to monitor themselves and learn how to control these problems and learn how to find other substitute activities that will keep the balance within their lives such that they may be able to continue to work constructively, perhaps not directly with children, but in other ways within the priesthood. We're not going to remake any of these people now, and it may be that for many of them, the best thing would be to try to find a way to allow them to leave the priesthood, perhaps still work in some way within the church, as they say in the police department, desk jobs for those who can no longer effectively work on the street. There are lots of things that can be done, but there is no idea that you can remake these people. I don't think any therapists would propose that.
You are a former priest who still has a lot of criticisms of the church. What keeps you in the church?
Well, the church is, as you will note in the interviews and in the polls, even in cities such as Boston or now Louisville, which have been terribly stricken by this problem of sexual abuse by its priests, the people make a distinction between the church as their family, the church as the source of the sacraments, and the church as an organization. And the church as a family is what most people like very much. They feel it is a family, and every family has problems. And this family is having big problems right now. But these ordinary people realize that it isn't the church that is the source of their spiritual support, the source of the sacraments. That's not the church that's in crisis. It's the church as an organization, and specifically as an hierarchical organization, that is in crisis. They have kept their faith in Catholicism, but they have lost their confidence in the leaders of the organized church. That is really what this crisis is all about. It has much less to do with these poor priests who get into this problem than it has to do with these bishops who have failed to manage this crisis, who have failed to identify and address it, who have allowed it to grow, and even with good hearts that many of them surely have found that now their own authority is the real victim of this difficult time. The bishops who go to Houston have to understand that the problem they're dealing with is not sexual abuse, it's their own authority and their own capacity to function as leaders in the Catholic Church. That is really what is the great crisis through which we are passing now.
Eugene Kennedy is a former priest and the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He's professor emeritus of psychology at Loyola University. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews music by violinist Ida Haendel. This is Fresh Air. Violinist Ida Haendel is much better known in Europe than here. That might change with some recent video and CD releases. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz hopes so. He considers Haendel the greatest living violinist. She was a child prodigy growing up in Poland, now in her 70s and living in Florida. Lloyd says she's at the top of her form. She's one of the performers who was featured in the documentary The Art of Violin, which was broadcast on public television.
That was Ida Haendel playing a Brahms Hungarian dance in 1956 on the documentary The Art of Violin. American audiences haven't had a chance to get to know her extraordinary playing, as well as audiences in Europe or Latin America. Lucky for me, she's been playing regularly with the Boston Symphony since her debut in 1990. Her Sibelius Violin Concerto with Sir Simon Rattle was one of the concerto performances against which I measure all others. Sibelius and Benjamin Britten and her teacher, George Enescu, were among the composers who loved how she played their work. She was just back in Boston playing Bruch's G minor concerto under the direction of Ilan Volkov, who is about half a century her junior. Here's the beginning of the Adagio, a love song of throbbing concentration, softer and slower than it's usually played. Haendel's violin is like a silken thread, indrawn, intimate, one long-held breath, and aware of the tears underlying every human emotion.
Thank you.
For years, her recordings have been hard to find here, but that's changing. VAI has issued a memorable video of Handel playing the Brahms Violin Concerto and Sarasate's Carmen Fantasy. There's not a wasted motion, none of the usual violinistic writhing or hair tossing. Every gesture serves the music. Her most recent recording is a 2-CD set of works for violin and piano. On one disc, scintillating pieces by Szymanowski, Bartok, and Enescu, with pianist Vladimir Ashkenazi. On the other, her Decca recordings from the 1940s. Some of the repertoire overlaps, so you can hear performances of Bartok's colorful and exuberant Romanian folk dances recorded almost 50 years apart. For all her hair-raising virtuosity, Handel seems never to have been interested in mere self-display. Here's Handel first in 1947 with pianist Ivor Newton, then in 1996 with Ashkenazi. Handel must be one of the most articulate musicians around. She speaks 7 languages fluently, including English, Russian, and Polish, and has published an autobiography. On a documentary she herself narrates, she says that were it not for her being a violinist, she and her family would have stayed in Poland and been murdered like all the Jewish people there. But by some divine decree, she says, it was a salvation for all of us, my immediate family and myself. Ida Handel's life really depended on her playing, and she still plays the violin as if it were her salvation.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed violinist Ida Handel's 2-CD set on Decca and video on VAI. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Ghost Soldiers, the epic account of World War II's greatest rescue mission by Hampton Sides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
David Lynch's 1986 film Blue Velvet is coming out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the film's stars, Dennis Hopper and Isabella Rossellini. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Was the light from the stars?